Welcome back to New Books in Political Science. My name is Heath Brown, and today I'll be talking to with Philip Krestimidis. Phil, did I pronounce your name correctly this time?
Well, it's close. Krestimidis.
This is the second time on, and by the third time, by your next book, I will have your name perfect. Pleasure to have you back on to talk about your latest book, which is called Migrants and Race in the U.S., Territorial Racism and the Alien Outside, published this year by Routledge. You're part of the two-timer club. For those that didn't listen to our first interview, why don't you briefly tell us a little bit about yourself, where you are, where you've been, and anything else interesting about yourself?
Sure. Well, I'm currently an associate professor of sociology at UMass Boston. I've been there, for some time now, just about almost a little over 8 years. But I've taught and at a few other institutions in Canada, South Florida. My alma mater is University of Minnesota. I've also been in the policy world, but this book is, as you mentioned, it is very theoretical. The first book was a bit more closely informed by, my history of practical policy work. And this book kind of, it does take a bit more of a macro historical and theoretical perspective that I guess has been informed by a lot of my reading and thinking since I, moved away from the policy world.
This, in addition to sort of the nature of the writing, it also seems to be a very personal book for you. So much so that you begin the book with some personal anecdotes. So I wonder if we can start by talking a little bit how your background motivates this line of scholarship.
Oh, yeah. Well, actually, the book was actually supposed to be more personal. And I guess because of the reading so much theory, it got more theoretical, I guess a bit more abstract than I wanted it to. I mean, initially, I wanted to, I should note that the personal angle of the book, it was very deliberate because, someone who, I've been teaching race ethnicity for some time. So I haven't published just in critical race theory, but I see myself as in part a critical race scholar. It just means people who just sort of do social construction of race type of work, that also looks at social inequality. And in that, line of academic writing, it's fairly common for people to use first-person narratives, to explore issues, autoethnography or also just ethnography, period, is used, quite often, or also interview-based research. So the idea of having someone like myself, I also forgot to mention, who's also a racial minority of, a Jamaican and Greek background, my family moved all over the place when I was young. I was born in Toronto and moved to England and Bahamas, and I grew up in South Florida. I'm the sort of person who doesn't have a real hometown per se, and that sort of shaped my experience. But the goal was really to write a book in the tradition of a lot of these, books written by, black feminist scholars and what have you, and other just, the scholars that foreground the author's personal experience and use it as a window, into the issue. And I began that way, even though honestly, it gets very macro, as you move on. And actually, I didn't want it to get that way, but that was just the direction it began to take, which is also in a way sort of how I write, where I use my experiences just because I feel like I need to be honest with people where this is not arbitrary why I'm writing it from this perspective. And I think you need to know who I am. But I'm also somewhat indifferent to my own experience because at some point you're using it as a jumping board to actually get beyond yourself while also being honest about where you're starting from, Because at the same time, I am, unlike a lot of other people who do write this, there's a lot of books written about this where it's just coming from, say, like an Asian American studies experience or just from a black female experience. And I am actually trying to, try to discuss what I call this field of visibility that really can, that affects, a wide range of people. I guess as a Jamaican, Greek, mixed black, whatever I am, person, I don't really have an obvious constituency out there, who's after the same as me. So I'm also hoping that Latino scholars and Asian studies people and all sorts of people of different backgrounds will hopefully see something useful in it.
It's a very interesting book, and much of the book, as you just said, is about these abstract notions. And I think, in fact, when you first mentioned the book to me, that's exactly what you focused on. So let's talk about some abstract notions and how you approach them in the book. You draw this distinction between racialized and racial discrimination. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what some of the differences are that you see and how that helps to set up much of your of the approach of the book.
Yeah, and I should note too that I'll definitely answer that question. But also, and maybe I'll get to this a little bit later. That the there's so many ways that you can get at this issue, and unfortunately, after you publish the books, there's always all the second guessing, and I don't know how it's going to be received because I do think that in part I'm making a somewhat controversial argument, at least in the context of some traditions of race scholarship in the U.S. And immigration is a very controversial issue too. So. I mean, I should emphasize here that the book really, you could look at this issue from many perspectives, but I really see it as an attempt to pluralize, to present like a pluralistic race analysis, saying that, essentially, migrants are racialized in ways that are distinct in some ways from, say, black racialization, which tends to really sort of historically define racialization in the U.S., so they can be racialized in ways that's similar to that history of black racialization, where they're seen mainly as non-whites. But when they are racialized, it's also possible for them to be racialized in qualitatively distinct ways, which actually, in a way, gets to the question you asked, which is, you could say that racialization just really has to do with the way that things are racially coded, and it doesn't necessarily, and the fact that something is racially coded doesn't necessarily mean that the racial coding is informed by a racist ideology. The fact that, you notice that somebody is black, or somebody looks Asian, even if they're not, maybe the Native American, or maybe, there are some, Central American people that look Asian-ish to people in the U.S., the fact that you notice those distinctions and you attach labels to them that are racial ethnic doesn't mean that we're racist, or the fact that someone might look at me, and think that, okay, I'm Latino in some context, or black in others, or not black enough in others, in of itself, that isn't being racist, but it is noticing, it's being aware of the, just the relevance of racial codes, So I sort of distinguish, this racial coding from, from actual acts of discrimination, which then use the racial code to discriminate. And also, in a way, also from racist ideologies as well, that you don't necessarily, have to think that somebody is inferior because you happen to notice or see them, in a certain racial light. Even though this is what gets a bit complex, is that also because the book does get into the history of it, I mean, the racial codes, even though in the present day, the fact that we notice them doesn't mean that we're racist, the racial codes do come from, out of a racist history. It's because, going back hundreds of years, our social world here has been structured in a racial way that was initially structured to justify inequality, justified in terms of race, that they do come out of a racist history, but it doesn't mean that, again, the racial code is being, the fact that we notice the racial code or that we use it, it doesn't necessarily automatically mean that we're racist.
Maybe we could play this out a little bit more, because I think a couple of these kind of dichotomies, for lack of a better term, are really at the heart of the book. And so maybe we can continue this by talking about how you conceptualize some of the differences or similarities between anti-immigrant and anti-black racism. This is another piece of what you're talking about. And how does that move ahead your argument, thinking about the difference between those two terms?
Yeah, well, it's a tough topic to talk about because I get it a little bit in the book, even though I could probably, but it's sort of like a tangential, observation that the history of race, especially to go back, to the early discourses on racial supremacy, is heavily weighted in moralism. It's these moralistic distinctions, I think, because of that history, there's a lot of moralism surrounding discourse, including also discourses on racial justice or, criticizing racism. And so I think because in the U.S., for obvious reasons, we have a history that has been defined, in large part by this history of, when we think about race, it's in terms of white-black. If you begin to steer the argument, or at least an analysis of race, away from that a little bit, sometimes it seems like you're doing something wrong, or you're trying to, perhaps you're even, you're sort of trying to water down, you know, the relevance of this legacy of anti-Black racism. And so it's, you know, the book gets into this in some depth, but I find that, you know, out of very good intentions, you know, that there are many, I think, migration scholars and also minorities doing migration scholarship that want to show that they're sympathetic to the issue of anti-Black racism, and also, you know, in the end, you know, like to frame, I guess, the issues of migration and race in ways that affirm their solidarity with the issue that Black people are going through in the U.S., right? And, yeah, and again, because of my own history, since, I mean, in many respects, I mean, I am a Black person, I mean, you know, definitely part of my legacy, you know, comes out of the Black experience, and I'm also somebody who's you know, been actually, like, a part in my scholarship, my peer community, you know, part of the Black community and the Black intellectual culture. You know, I mean, I understand where that's, I guess you could say, where that's all coming from, you know, like that desire to sort of show that your solidarity with this other group. But as a result, it leads to a situation where sometimes I think people are, it gets overlooked or just a bit shy about acknowledging the ways in which, you know, migrants can be set apart racially from other minorities, you know, for good or for ill. I mean, oftentimes in the literature, what it talks about, and it does definitely happen, of how migrants can be deemed more acceptable by U.S. natives by distinguishing them from Blacks. You know, so the migrant gets accepted because they really push themselves away from Blacks and emphasize their non-Blackness, you know. And that definitely happens on all levels. Like, this book's written about South Asians and also just other Southeast Asians and you know, and even other also Black immigrants as well, you know, that look at that dynamic, you know. But I think also the thing is that what I do is I also try to emphasize, you know, the relevance, even though I look in the broad sweep of history, but also the relevance of, you know, what's happened since the new migration, you know, that really began to peak in the early 90s. And we live in an era now where it's, you know, it's odd. When I began this book, the recession was just beginning to, like, sink in, you know. And I think when I, you know, really, that this book was informed really by experiences, like frustrations I had with doing community work and dealing with this field of racial visibility. And honestly, I think acts of anti-immigrant racism that didn't click in people's minds because it didn't conform to their, you know, how they saw race, you know, like normally working. But these are experiences.
And could
really,
you?
I'm sorry. Yeah.
Yeah. Let me just ask you for: is there an example of this that you think really does make this point? You provided numerous examples of the book, but is there one that you think kind of, you know, tells this story clearly?
Okay. Well, I'd say that. Well, I mean, I use a few examples in the book. I mean, like, one example I use, I do begin the book with examples in South Florida, you know, in terms of, like, the macro context of South Florida, it's a really good example because you have a situation where, you know, there's an African American population, like a Native population, which has historically felt marginalized and was really, in part, I guess you could say, they were disadvantaged by the flow of Cuban migrants that came over, like, in the 1960s and 70s. Many of whom initially came from the Cuban upper class, and so there was this pre-existing tension, you know, between, you know, Black minorities feeling that they were kind of pushed aside by the federal government, you know, for this aid that really went to help these anti-communist Latinos, you know, and that kind of shaped this history, which really wasn't about just race. It was about politics and other things, but it shaped this context in which there is this longstanding, I guess you could say, history of tensions between native-born minorities and immigrant minorities in South Florida. Like, it's further complicated, like, when you have Central American and Latinos, you know, from other parts of the world, you know, from other parts of Latin America coming in there, Haitian migrants coming in there. And me sort of growing up in South Florida, I really felt this, like a lot of this palpable just tension between these different minority groups, you know, especially given that it really was sort of like a majority minority part of the world at that time. I mean, like most people in Dade, Broward County when I was growing up, like, really were non-white. You know, but as a result of that, there's a lot of tension, you know, and so I saw a lot of that going on, practically speaking. But in the book, like one clear example I used, there was the Bill Cosby for President meme or email hoax that went around, right? That, you know, which came out, I think, just about like a few months after, you know, Obama, you know, I guess, you know, declared his, well, like, you know, his I believe it was around the same time as the Obama bid for presidency, you know, like his 2008 candidacy. You know, and Bill Cosby was falsely associated with essentially like this sort of, popular nationalist anti-immigrant campaign, like a platform, you know, which among other things called for, shutting down the borders and, and orders to shoot on, orders not to shoot on immigrants, like as long as they're going south across the border, that it implicitly means that, if you can shoot them if they're coming towards the border, if you're trying to enter, and if you're going to sort of, I guess you could say classic sort of nativist tropes, in terms of what like a nativist policy platform would be. And I mentioned in the book about, how, it's a kind of really kind of funny, odd little, email hoax that made its way around various, conservative websites, but it really was indicative of this broader body of discourse that really was being cultivated, in the 90s and still around today, as well, where there is an attempt to sort of construct, black natives as these unique victims of immigration. And by the way, there also is, I mentioned the book, there is some structural proof of that, native born minorities are, more vulnerable, than especially lower skilled native born minorities are more vulnerable to displacement, than other native workers. But there really was an attempt in that email hoax to basically, I guess you could say fan the flames of that tension, and to produce this discourse in which, blacks can be, can be sort of rehabilitated as fellow natives with whites, but while at the same time, kind of drawn attention to this field of visibility in which, you could say the person who is visibly, or culturally conspicuously non-white and non-native becomes seen as the source of the new race problem, in a way, right. But it's a different kind of race problem. So that's one really concrete example that I spent some time talking about.
Yeah. Now, in chapter six, you move from the abstract to the somewhat more specific. Mm-hmm. I wonder how this discussion and some of these abstract ideas relate to immigration today and to ideas of illegality and visa status that you really address towards the end of the book.
Yeah. Well. Yeah. Sure. They do. Well, the thing is that this is one of the things that when you get into the actual, to begin connecting it to policy issues. I mean, it raises, the thing is that my critique of, my attempt, just to draw attention to the fact that there is this, you could say, field of visibility in which migrants can be racially distinguished from native whites and blacks, that there's a kind of racialization that's distinct to migrants. That was just a general point that I'm making in the book. But of course, that isn't necessarily the same thing as actually, proposing a policy solution for, all the complexities of migration policy today. So for example, even if I sort of point critically to the fact that, immigrant racialization exists, it doesn't mean, for example, that there aren't real problems with the way that migration works in the U.S. today, or that there isn't, there aren't exploitative migration policies. So in chapter six, one thing I could pull out, and I was dealing with that, is and I don't know if this maybe gets at what you were asking me to, so definitely feel free to steer me if I'm going a bit off track, is that I do point out how, for example, there is a way in which, immigration enforcement, can be guided by, racialized profiles, which, get focused on a certain part of town that's known to have, Latinos, or where somebody, because they look Latino, might be screened, more closely than someone else. There are a lot of anecdotes, that come out of the research on that. But where the policing of this national border, and it really isn't the policing of the literal border, it really all this policing happens inside the nation. It really, if you look at it in the macro picture, it isn't really articulated necessarily with this, nationalist, shut down the border, enforcement agenda. It really is something that can be articulated with a, I believe I use the term neoliberal a few places in the book, you know, but with a much more kind of fluid, I guess you could say, kind of an enforcement that just selectively targets, you know, migrant populations for the purposes of labor market regulation. You know, like throughout U.S. history, and, you know, there's people like going back to Kitty Kalavita, who really, I think, did the first, at least great study that I'm aware of on this, on Operation Wetback, you know, where Operation Wetback is, and I mentioned this even in the first book, Immigration Crucible, too, you know, where it sometimes is framed as this, you know, kind of a border control effort, you know, but it largely was, you know, this effort to reduce the size of a quote unquote surplus population of guest workers, you know, and unauthorized migrants when they were deemed to be, you know, too many of them, you know, like a glut of them in local labor markets. And after that population was reduced, you know, sufficiently, it did grow again over time, you know, and so the other really is evidence, you know, at least, you know, of this sort of labor market regulation model of immigration enforcement, which really is about, you know, just keeping the migrant workforce at an optimal level, you know, for employers, more so than, you know, regulating it for the sake of protecting, you know, like wages for native workers, and, you know, or whatever else, or just keeping labor markets tight, you know. And there's this argument that also comes out of even some of the unions today, you know, as well, you know, that really immigration enforcement is, at least not by itself, is not really the most effective way of dealing with a lot of the economic issues, that people are concerned about, like when it comes to displacement of native workers. It really, they can need better labor law enforcement, you know, or at least stronger labor law enforcement in tandem with, you know, maybe, you know, with a more reasonable immigration enforcement, you know. But the kind of immigration enforcement that we're seeing now is, you know, again, that's a whole other body of, I guess, analysis, which is related to the book, which I don't get to in great depth, but I do touch on it in chapter 6, you know, but that kind of enforcement, the enforcement we see now, it still seems to be in large part in line with, you know, this history of regulating labor markets for the sake of, you know, of, I guess, improving their productivity and the utility for employers, I guess you could say.
Right.
You know, but the key thing, though, is, which I do mention in the book, is that how, though, this field of immigrant visibility or immigrant racialization can be articulated with that, because you get focused on, you know, who belongs in the nation, you know, or not, and then how they get symbolized just by someone's cultural difference or their appearance, and then how, you know, that might sort of lead people just to sort of, you know, be, you know, so like see it as just sort of normal common sense that certain folks get to work and certain folks don't, without really thinking about, well, does this racialize common sense, or even do these national distinctions really get at the root of, you know, the economic problems facing native workers, for example, you know, yeah, or migrant workers, right?
No, I really enjoyed the book. I enjoyed the first book. I don't know if it was your first book, but I enjoyed the first book we had on the podcast, and I enjoyed this latest one. Phil's book is titled Migrants and Race in the U.S., Territorial Racism and the Alien/Outside, published and available through Routledge this year. Phil, thank you very much for your time today.
Okay, thanks a lot, Heath. Yes, and thanks again for being willing to interview me, like, the second time.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you so much.